headlines. Yes, Saudi warplanes target a communications building in Yemen's Hodeidah province, killing at least 3 people and injuring 17 others. Iran's president calls for cooperation among independent states to stand against sanctions on nations as a new form of domination. Also ahead, Iran says Israel remains as the only apartheid regime in the world with racist and expansionist ideology, policies, and practices. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, a Saudi-led coalition carries out fresh air strikes against the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah. Yemeni media reported that the coalition's warplanes targeted a communication building and a nearby sports stadium in the city overnight. At least 3 people have been killed and 17 others wounded in the attack. Most of the victims are said to be children who were playing near the building. Yemen's capital and other major cities have seen relentless nighttime airstrikes by Saudi and Emirati warplanes. In recent days, the attacks have killed dozens of civilians, including women and children. The increase in attacks come after the Yemeni army successfully hit targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates with drone and missiles. The UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition, waging a deadly war against Yemen since 2015. It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The Iranian president slams sanctions as a new form of domination, calling for a collective response from independent nations to counter such measures.
Sanctioning nations is a common form of new domination. Encountering it requires cooperation of sovereign states and a collective response. Otherwise, sanctions will affect all countries, even U.S. allies, under various pretexts.
Ibrahim Raisi denounced sanctions as part of a broader agenda to undermine sovereign states. The Iranian president noted that independent nations are experiencing a historic growth in power, while the U.S. is suffering its weakest position. In a reference to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, Raisi said Tehran is serious about reaching an agreement only if the other signatories are serious about removing sanctions in an effective and practical manner.
We are not satisfied with anything less than our rights. The Islamic Republic of Iran is serious about reaching an agreement if the other parties are serious about removing the sanctions effectively and operationally.
Raisi reiterated that based on a decree from the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, nuclear weapons have no place in the country's military doctrine. He made the remarks in an address to the lower house of the Russian parliament on the second and final day of his official visit to Moscow. Raisi said Iran is seeking maximum interaction with all countries around the world, especially its neighbors and allies. He once again called for further expansion of ties between Tehran and Moscow. This, he said, can help prevent the presence of third parties in the region and help sustain regional peace and stability. Joining us is Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco, and also Jason Unruhe, a political commentator from Niagara Falls. Gentlemen, welcome. Richard, if I start with you, it's one sentence from the Iranian president's speech that stands out, where he says that independent nations are experiencing a historic power, or growth in power, I should say, while the U.S. is suffering its weakest position. And that may not necessarily relate to economics, but or financial position. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's true. If we look at the situation in historical perspective, it was 70 years ago that the U.S. and Britain imposed a blockade and a complete embargo on the sale of oil, of Iranian oil, after the Mossadegh government had nationalized the oil fields. And that created chaos in the economy and led to the downfall of the Mossadegh government within a relatively short period of time, within a couple of years or a little bit less. Now we see the sanctions that are being imposed, but they're not having that same result. They are having the result of creating incredible suffering on the population and causing you know, just all kinds of hardships for people. It's terrible. It's a crime. I really believe it should be considered, I think these kind of sanctions should be considered a crime against humanity. But they're not having the desired effect of bringing about regime change, because that's what the U.S. policy really has been ever since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. It's been regime change. They're not succeeding in that, and I think that that shows us that the power, the relationships of power have shifted and are continuing to shift.
Right. And then Jason, President Raisi also says sanctions are part of a broader agenda to undermine sovereign states. As well as, you know, sovereign states, independent states, democratic states, those who have elections, they're the ones who are the targets of American sanctions, not dictatorships or authoritarian regimes.
Well, no. Whether or not they're democratic is completely irrelevant. Whether or not they have a good human rights record or not is irrelevant. It's a matter of whether or not they're going to carry out American interests. Obviously, many countries are horribly despotic, for example, Saudi Arabia, and they never place any sanctions upon them and any of the barbarous acts that they commit. Because this isn't really about whether or not someone's democratic. This is not really about whether someone respects or disrespects human rights. It's about carrying out U.S. interests, and particularly in this case, U.S. imperialist interests. And anyone who doesn't bow to just do whatever it is that the United States wants them to do, whoever is not willing to be a client state, regardless of their political ideology, regardless of their economic status, those are the ones that are going to be targeted by the United States for sanctions. Now, of course, human rights, etc., are often used as a justification for doing so, but I don't see that as being really the case. That's just an excuse. I mean, nobody with a serious face can point to Venezuela or Iran and say that they're an evil, despotic, you know, dictatorship, while in the same breath turn around and say that Saudi Arabia is a bastion of freedom and democracy, or even Israel, for that matter. So it is very clear, actual integrity is not what this is about. This is about forwarding U.S. imperialist interests. And as long as you're willing to serve the U.S. empire, you are not the ones who are going to be sanctioned by the United States and its near monopolistic position on world trade, particularly with regards to payment systems.
Right. And then Richard, somewhere in President Raisi's speech, was some free advice to countries in the East and the West, that at some point, you know, the United States, or you can't really depend on the United States for security and other aspects. How much is the U.S. concerned about its decline as an empire, or has that empire already collapsed?
Well, I don't think it's collapsed. The U.S. remains the number one military power in the world, and is a very, you know, a big economic power as well. But certainly the U.S. position has declined, and U.S. doctrine, as exemplified in the national security strategy, a number of them over the years, going back to the months immediately after the fall of the Soviet Union, has been that there should be the center core of the doctrine has been that there should be one superpower in the world, and no other country should be allowed to rise to challenge the U.S. position of the sole superpower after the fall of the USSR. So this is what really moves U.S. policy in many ways. I agree with your other guests that if you follow, you know, you do what the U.S. leaders and the ruling elite in the U.S. want you to do, you don't get sanctioned. But you have just absurd rationale, like this whole idea that we are in competition with China over the who will win the 21st century. That has nothing to do with the interests of the people, and we, the people, have no possible standing in that. This is all about the domination, global domination, and the fact that the China has grown in strength, Iran has grown in strength, Russia has grown in strength. These are seen as being challenges to global hegemony on the part of the United States.
Interesting points, Richard. And Jason, Richard, their notes of that the United States is a military power. Jason, can you remember the last time that the United States won militarily?
I'm sure there's probably some small conflict. Like, they technically defeated the military of Iraq, but that's not really saying much, that considering, you know, the size difference between the two militaries as well as access to resources. Well, the United States is very good at essentially beating up people who have very limited ability to defend themselves, but when it comes to actual real stand-up wars, the United States has a much more difficult time in that regard. For example, the reason there hasn't been any large-scale military conflict against Iran has largely to do with the Millennium Challenge. That was a simulation done in 2002 where the United States simulated a war with Iran, and in every possible scenario, the United States actually lost the war until they created a scenario that they essentially could not lose in. That's on Wikipedia, that's available for anybody to read. I think that despite the arrogance of much of the political leadership, I think the military leadership is aware of many of its limitations in what it can and can't do.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts and your contribution. Let me thank our guests for their time. Richard Becker is from the Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco, and Jason Nruhe, a political commentator from Niagara Falls. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Now, negotiations are underway in Austria's capital, Vienna, between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran deal, while the European and American diplomats express concern about the slow pace of the talks. Iran says an agreement is within reach if the US removes sanctions in a verifiable manner and gives assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Our Vienna correspondent, Homolezki, has more.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration." Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Omar Lizki, Vienna.
Iran says the Israeli regime has remained as the only apartheid regime in the world with racist and expansionist ideology, policies and practices. In a statement, Iran's UN ambassador Majid Takht-Ravanchi slammed Israel for exploiting the sufferings of the Jewish people in the past as a pretext to commit or justify new genocides and crimes. The statement notes that despite international resolutions condemning Zionism and colonialism, Israel has continued to pursue its expansionist interests through all means. It also stresses that the systematic violation of the rights of the Palestinian people, including their inherent right to self-determination, is a crime against humanity that cannot be justified. The statement insists that the international community should hold the Israeli regime accountable for perpetrating such crimes. COVID-19 keeps raging on in Europe. The United Kingdom reports nearly 108,000 new daily cases, up more than 10,000 from the day before. British authorities say 330 more people succumbed to the virus in the past day. In England, infections are at their highest level among school children since the pandemic broke out. Meanwhile, Italy has logged close to 190 cases. In France, more than 425,000 people have tested positive. Soaring COVID figures have prompted French teachers to stage a protest in the French capital, Paris, to demand better protection for students and staff. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. inflation hit its fastest pace in nearly four decades last year, as pandemic-related supply and demand imbalances, along with stimulus intended to shore up the economy, pushed prices up at a 7% annual rate. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Gune Guilford, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. inflation hit 7% in December, fastest pace since 1982. Stay tuned for more. U.S. inflation hit its fastest pace in nearly four decades last year, as pandemic-related supply and demand imbalances, along with the stimulus intended to shore up the economy, pushed prices up at a 7% annual rate. The U.S. Labor Department said recently the Consumer Price Index, which measures what consumers pay for goods and services, rose 7% in December from the same month a year earlier, up from 6.8% in November. That was the fastest since 1982 and marked the third straight month in which inflation exceeded 6%. The so-called core price index, which excludes the often volatile categories of food and energy, climbed 5.5% in December from a year earlier. That was a bigger increase than November's 4.9% rise and the highest rate since 1991. On a monthly basis, the CPI increased a seasonally adjusted 0.5% in December from the preceding month, decelerating from October and November. The last time consumer prices clocked in at such an annual increase was in June 1982, but the circumstances were very different from today. While inflation right now is rising, back then it was falling after peaking at 14.8% in 1980, when Jimmy Carter was still president. By then, newly installed Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker had set out to crush inflation by raising interest rates dramatically, causing a brief recession in 1980. As rates reached 19% in 1981, a much deeper recession began. By the summer of 1982, both inflation and interest rates were falling sharply. Today, the COVID-19 pandemic has caused supply chain disruptions and a shortage of goods and materials, particularly autos, coupled with the strong demand from consumers flush with the benefits of government stimulus are behind the inflation surge. Prices for autos, furniture, and other durable goods continue to drive much of the inflationary surge, fueled by largely pandemic-related imbalances of supply and demand that most economists expect to fade as COVID-19's impact on economic activity eases. Prices of used cars and trucks soared 37.3% in December from a year earlier, while living room, kitchen, and dining room furniture jumped 17.3%. Economists and the Federal Reserve expect inflation to ease this year as supply bottlenecks clear and demand normalizes. But the Omicron variant of COVID-19 has renewed uncertainty about the economic outlook as the pandemic continues. The December employment report signaled continued tightening of the job market, with the unemployment rate dropping to 3.9% from 4.2% in November, the Labor Department said, giving workers additional leverage on pay. While wages advanced last year at a faster pace than before the pandemic, they didn't increase enough to keep up with the rise in inflation, with average hourly wages rising 4.7% in December from a year earlier. In December, some 49% of small businesses said they plan to raise prices in the next 3 months. On net, according to the National Federation of Independent Business Trade Association, Omicron's uniquely rapid spread has worsened the labor shortage by driving up workplace absences. Manufacturing companies are adopting expensive solutions to keep factories running so they can meet booming demand. FedEx Corporation said recently that Omicron is causing staffing shortages and delaying shipments. John Merritt, vice president of Ellen Bell Catering in Napa, California, said staffing was an immediate issue when demand for weddings or other big events came surging back last June. The company raised wages 50% in a bid to retain workers and hire new ones, but it still had to rely on the services of temp agencies. Due to increased labor costs, along with soaring prices for meat, cheese, and white-based products, the company didn't make a profit last year. Demand for furniture and other goods has boomed during the pandemic, straining supply chains and fueling much of the inflation surge. In some industries, scarce materials have hamstrung production. The most prominent example is a shortage of semiconductors that has curbed auto production, sending prices for cars and trucks soaring. Despite disruptions from Omicron, there are some indications of improvement in supply chain woes. Also, economists expect price pressures from supply constraints to be replaced by higher rent and medical care costs that tend to be more persistent. Rent, which accounts for nearly one-third of the CPI, has begun accelerating in recent months. High inflation has prompted some consumers to rein in spending.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us present you the statement of the Holy Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, on the timeless wisdom of God Almighty's final revelation to mankind, the Holy Quran. The Book of Allah is the guide of its followers towards the pleasure of Allah. Listening carefully to it leads to salvation. The enlightened and conspicuous evidences and proofs of Allah can be obtained through it, and also the knowledge of His interpreted intentions and fear invoking constraining prohibitions. His sufficing testimonies and conspicuous arguments and desired virtues and allowed endowments and gifts and obligatory divine laws.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and Imam Musa al-Kazim was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. We find in the various books in which Islamic historians and biographers have written extensively that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam's personality was full of noble qualities such as generosity. And so historians have unanimously agreed that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was the most generous of the people, and he was the greatest among the people when it came to giving to the needy. It is said that his purses were proverbial, so that the people had said, "We wonder at him to whom Musa's purses come, while he would still complain of poverty." And so, generosity is one of those noble qualities which can be seen clearly in the beautiful personality of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These, dear friends, are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام وقد سئل عن الكبائر هل تخرج من الإيمان؟ نعم، وما دون الكبائر. قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله: لا يزني الزاني وهو مؤمن، ولا يسرق السارق وهو مؤمن.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, when asked about the grave sins and whether they expel one from faith, replied, "Yes." And when asked about other than grave sins, stated, "The Prophet stated, an adulterer would never commit adultery whilst still a believer, and a thief would never steal while still a believer."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So when talking about these beautiful dialogues and these conversations of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that there is a very interesting tradition where Imam al-Kazim, peace be upon him, he warns his Shias against taking part in the government of Harun al-Rashid, and he warns his Shias to not undertake a job within the governmental establishment of Harun al-Rashid, the Abbasid Caliph.
So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to Ziyad bin Salama, "O Ziyad, if I was thrown down a tremendous height and cut into pieces, it would be more lovable to me than that I undertook a work for them, the Abbasids, or walked on a carpet of a man from them, the Abbasids." So we find, dear friends, that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam resisted and opposed Harun al-Rashid's government with this kind of intense resistance, because following someone such as Harun al-Rashid would efface justice. It would change the laws of Allah. It would erase the truth. It would give life to falsehood, and it would destroy Islam. It is for this reason that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam made it forbidden for his Shias to cooperate with Harun al-Rashid, the Abbasid caliph, and his governmental apparatus. But Imam al-Kadhim excluded those very few people who, via their jobs, could save the Muslims from oppression and tyranny and could grant the needs of the believers. This kind of job that could save the Muslims from oppression and tyranny and help to grant the needs of the believers and the safety of the believers was regarded as lawful by Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, as can be seen in his conversations with Ali bin Yaqdeen. So, a beautiful lesson here that we learn from this dialogue of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that we should be very wary of working for a tyrannical and oppressive government to the extent that we can. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
They say that when Imam was taken into prison by Harun Rashid, he was persecuted, and eventually to the extent that there are different narrations that we have, but one of the most famous one in regards to his shahadat was that he was given that poison. When Imam was given that poison, all alone in that prison, and as they say that whenever the Imam suffers, they remember their grandmother Fatimatul Zahra salamullah alayha, Imam Hussein alayhi salam the same, Imam Radha alayhi salam the same, Imam Musa Kazim alayhi salam, because Hazrat Fatimatul Zahra salamullah alayha is hujjat upon the Imam. She is the point of reference. Imam given that poison and he is suffering, and eventually nobody there to really aid and assist the Imam in this prison all alone. Where is Imam Radha? Where are others, the close ones? And he dies, and when he dies, when he becomes shaheed, the body is covered with the cloth, and two guards were called to really lift the body and to take out of this prison to another chamber. When they wanted to lift the body, they said that it is so heavy. Why is this body so heavy? When they remove the cloth from this body, they saw the Imam in chains. This was the only Imam who was prison and who became shaheed in chains. Other Imams were given poison. Other Imams became shaheed by sword or by poison, but other Imams, when they became shaheed, they were not in chains.
Thank
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
On January 10th, Pope Francis issued a warning against so-called cancel culture, a practice to ostracize people for making remarks that are considered to be politically incorrect. The Pope pointed out cancel culture is invading many circles and public institutions. As a result, agendas are increasingly dictated by a mindset that rejects the natural foundations of humanity and the cultural roots that constitute the identity of many people. Cancel culture has also raised the ire of politicians of all stripes across the world.
Still, many people from various religious traditions are concerned about the lack of religious protection against the prevalence of cancel culture in Australian life. It's true, it's there, it's real. Mr. Speaker, the citizens of liberal democracy should never be fearful about what they believe, the lives they lead, or the God they follow, if indeed they choose to follow one or acknowledge one at all. Australians shouldn't have to worry about looking over their shoulder, fearful of offending an anonymous person on Twitter, cowardly, sitting there abusing and harassing them for their faith, or transgressing against political or social zeitgeists.
Even a man like Donald Trump has been complaining about cancel culture, calling it a weapon in the hands of totalitarianism, what he himself has been accused of.
One of their political weapons is cancel culture, driving people from their jobs, shaming dissenters, and demanding total submission from anyone who disagrees. This is the very definition of totalitarianism. And it is completely alien to our culture and to our values, and it has absolutely no place in the United States of America.
On the other hand, the proponents of cancel culture say this is a tool of social justice in combating public figures with far-reaching influence. The cases of Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, and Kevin Spacey, who faced allegations of rape and sexual assault and were effectively cancelled, are impossible to ignore. They say cancel practice is a public call for accountability and boycotting of people of power and influence. All these arguments and counter-arguments around cancel culture have made it a polarizing topic of debate across the world. Last January, American actor Bryan Cranston said his wish for 2021 was for cancel culture to end, adding, "I think we're unfortunately in a coarser environment. I think our societies have become harder and less understanding, less tolerant, less forgiving. My question for today is, where does forgiveness live in our society?" But cancel culture is still out there with a familiar pattern. A celebrity does or says something not politically correct, a public backlash, often fueled on social media, follows. Then come the calls to cancel the person, which means effectively terminating their career. Given all its pros and cons, cancel culture seems to have spun out of control when it comes to the trans community. In fact, it has become a new form of mob intimidation to ruin the career of anyone who dares to challenge the community's narrative on gender and sexuality. Any minor criticism or joke targeting the community is responded to with a smear campaign and a barrage of insults and intimidation. In October last year, the African-American stand-up comedian Dave Chappelle came under fire after his stand-up special for Netflix outraged the transgender community.
We as trans people and non-binary people aren't getting visibility or respect in the entertainment industry to begin with. And to have something like Dave Chappelle's special not be noted that it's promoting discrimination and hate conversation is very hurtful to the activism and the cause that we're trying to progress ourselves in the industry.
In his special, Chappelle merely said gender is a fact and that LGBT people are too sensitive. Soon he became the target of cancel culture.
This film that I made was invited to every film festival in the United States, and some of those invitations I accepted. And when this controversy came out about the closer, they began disinviting me from these film festivals. And now, today, not a film company, not a movie studio, not a film festival. Nobody will touch this film. Thank God for Tetz Randall's and Netflix. He's the only one that didn't cancel me yet. To the transgender community, I am more than willing to give you an audience. But you will not summon me. I am not bending to anybody's demands.
Perhaps the most prominent target of this aggressive practice is J.K. Rowling. The immensely popular creator of Harry Potter has been cancelled repeatedly for her comments considered by the trans community as transphobic. She initially drew fierce criticism from the community in June 2020 for objecting to the avoidance of the word woman. In one of her tweets, she wrote, "People who menstruate. I'm sure there used to be a word for those people. Someone help me out. Womben? Wimpund? Womund?"
For a specific instance of something which one would identify as being transphobic, I mean, obviously you don't have the tweets in front of you. Can you just give us one so people understand where you're coming from?
Well, she's made comments about women having certain body parts when we know that, you know, if you're transgender, you might not have a cervix if you've transitioned and you might be a man. Mm-hmm. And you know, those comments are simply created to stir up hatred. We shouldn't judge people on the combination of organs they have, but on how they identify.
Dawn Neeson?
Well, I'd like to say that there's one organ Benjamin's missing tonight, and that's a brain, because there is absolutely nothing wrong with a woman saying that a woman has a cervix and it's okay to call her a woman. A woman has a womb. A woman doesn't chest breed, she breastfeeds. And, you know, it's the sheer, again, misogyny involved in this. If you go onto the NHS website for cervical cancer, it says people with cervixes. There's no mention of the word woman. If you go on to the male version for male cancers, it says men. Why? What's the difference? What is wrong with using the word woman? I can't even say it straight, I'm so angry about this. But, you know, women have been fighting to have their voices heard since the first feminist meeting, I think it was around in the 1860s back in America. And now, after all those decades of fighting to be heard, we are being told to shut up by men.
Rowling has also been criticised for disputing the idea that male and female sexes did not exist. She wrote, "If sex isn't real, there's no same-sex attraction. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women globally is erased. Erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives. It isn't hate to speak the truth." Whereas Rowling is still hugely popular across the world, she cannot avoid the pinch of cancel culture. At the Harry Potter 20-year reunion special, which premiered on January 1st on HBO Max, J.K. Rowling had a minor presence. The Washington Post speculated that Warner Bros. didn't want the show to carry any hint of controversy. In fact, she wasn't allowed to be there to celebrate her own book. One of the most significant cultural forces of the past two decades was practically cancelled for her rather mild comments about the trans community. Rowling is now receiving a new wave of criticism after sharing an article that objected to Police Scotland's announced policy of classifying rapists as women if they identify as such. While Rowling's comments on sex and gender have sparked attacks against her reputation, a new Rasmussen poll shows that 75% of American adults agree with her. According to the survey firm, the latest Rasmussen Report's national telephone and online surveys finds that 75% of American adults agree that there are only two genders, male and female. Cancel culture in the hands of the trans community has created a spiral of silence that takes out other people's freedom of expression by intimidating them into silence. It has morphed into an aggressive force to reverse discrimination against the majority in the interests of the minority, leaving no room for discussion or dialogue.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading UN Policies Expand Theater of Yemen War into UAE. Stay tuned for more. The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. This appears fine on paper, especially on the UN Charter, but in practice, the so-called world body has long deviated from its goals and allowed itself to be used as a tool for serving the vested interests of some of its founding members, especially the US. We in Iran suffered this stepmotherly treatment during the eight-year war the United States had imposed upon us in 1980s through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. Neither the bloodthirsty dictator's frequent attacks on ships, railways, buses, and planes were condemned, nor his targeting of city centers and use of chemical weapons, let alone the denunciation of the US for its role in openly siding with Saddam in the war imposed upon the Islamic Republic. This same negative attitude of the UN towards the oppressed Palestinian people over the past 74 years is now fully evident in Yemen, where for the past 7 years, the Arab world's most impoverished country is subjected to the US-backed Saudi-UAE invasion that has destroyed the infrastructure and killed almost 400,000 men, women and children. The UN, instead of naming the aggressors and demanding end of aggression, calls Yemen's defenders rebels for protecting their homeland and has banned any supply of weapons to them, while turning a blind eye to the massive flow of lethal American, British and French armaments to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to continue more crimes against humanity. The other day, it urged Yemen's government in Sana'a to release a UAE ship, which had been impounded for carrying sophisticated weapons to the mercenaries prolonging the war. The Yemeni government has rightfully rejected the release of Raubi, which was carrying military equipment, and charged the UN of siding with murderers who violate international law. Sana'a also deplored the hypocrisy of the world body for its refusal to criticize the continued bombing of Yemeni towns and cities by the Saudi Air Force and the active involvement of the UAE to fuel the flames of war in Shabwa, Ma'arib and other regions. After due warnings to the UAE to desist from its destabilizing role in Yemen, the popular Ansarullah movements had no other choice but to retaliate by targeting industrial and military sites in Abu Dhabi while destroying a UAE military transport plane in Shabwa in central Yemen. This means, because of the dubious policies of the UN, the theater of the seven-year war is expanding and may cause death and destruction on a wide scale in the Persian Gulf region that accounts for 20% of the world's crude oil supplies. The deaths that occurred at Abu Dhabi International Airport and in the Musaffa industrial area, where three oil tankers were set ablaze through precision strikes, rests solely on the UN shoulders. If the UAE continues its sedition in Yemen, then it should brace for more such drone or ballistic missile attacks that would trigger a massive exodus back home of foreign workers along with economic collapse, all because of the negative role of the United Nations organization.
What is it you would be trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.